You're listening to the EWN Podcast Network.
Welcome to Raising a Powerful Girl, a community and education platform that empowers parents and caretakers to foster independence, leadership, and strong personal identity in girls so they can change the world. Now, here is the founder and your host, Maria Fuller.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Raising a Powerful Girl. I'm the founder and your host, Maria Fuller. Before we get started, let's make sure you know where to find me. You can find more information about our education and community platform at raisingapowerfulgirl.com. And you can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Raising a Powerful Girl. Make sure to connect with us on social media to find out our latest news, learn tips and tricks, submit your questions, and continue our enlightening conversations. And now, let's get on with today's show. You're always uncooperative. You never pick up your clothes. You make me furious. How many times a day do you find yourself saying or thinking these things about your kids or these kinds of things about yourself? I should be folding the piles of laundry right now. I have to drive soccer carpool again. These are examples of what communication experts call disempowering language. Negative thoughts are words that we may take for granted as part of our everyday vocabulary. It's a type of language that leaves us feeling more like pawns in someone else's game rather than the masters of our own destiny. Often, when we use disempowering language, it's a direct reflection of disempowered feelings we may have, which commonly arise under stress. Although the statements above might seem harmless, disempowering language can have a profound effect on the feelings and behaviors of our children and ourselves. Did you notice a slight loss of energy or increased discomfort when hearing the phrases above? The way we express ourselves, our choice of words, and our tone of voice creates energy that either gives power or takes power away. When we speak, we exercise the power of language to transform reality. Because of its power to influence our beliefs, disempowering language can undermine our parenting goals. This happens because what we focus on determines most of what we see. For example, when a parent says to a child, "You're always uncooperative," parent and child log the comments as data. With repetition, this cycle of behavior and response reinforces in our mind and in the child's belief that she's uncooperative, although that's far from our goal. My guest today is Sierra Sullivan. Sierra is a metamorphosis mentor, a title of her own creation, as she feels it more accurately and simply explains how she sees her role in working with others. It's her goal to help guide others on their path of uncovering and embracing their passion so that they can lead with their best foot forward in every area of their lives. Sierra has an educational background in applied psychology with a focus on the fields of cognitive behavioral and positive psychology, as well as earning certifications in clinical hypnotherapy and neuro-linguistic programming. She's also picked up many other tools along the way, which have helped her to personally reach new levels of comfort and happiness and have allowed her the wonderful opportunity to embrace her passion and bring both comfort and happiness to those she works with. Okay, well, welcome, Sierra. I'm so happy to have you here today.
Thank you for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
So you said something. Well, you call yourself a metamorphosis mentor, and I love that. You know, when I first read that about you, I immediately thought of, you know, like a cocoon to a butterfly. Can you tell me what that means?
Absolutely. You hit it the nail on the head. I've had several people kind of bring that up and go, "So tell me more about what you do." And I'm just like, I tried to pick a name that kind of says it all. What I really like to do in my work and just in my day-to-day life is help foster growth. And I do that by mentoring people through whatever kind of transitionary phases they are in life. And there's so many that we go through, from the simplest of moving to changing jobs to losing people that we're close to. But particularly, a lot of my area of focus has been around anxiety, post-traumatic stress, things like that. And transitioning out of living in that every day into being happy and calm is one of the most difficult transitions for my clients. And so there was a quote that I read many years ago, and it stuck with me, and it's kind of really crafted a lot of this around it, is that quote of, "Just when the caterpillar thought that life was over. It became a beautiful butterfly. And that's how it can feel for so many of my clients, is they hit that moment of, I'm done. I can't possibly do this anymore. I don't know how I'm going to get through another day. And then they find the light and they come through more beautiful than they could have ever imagined.
I love that for so many reasons. First, you know, sparks in my mind is being a woman entrepreneur, being a mother. We're constantly going through so many transitions in life, right? Girls go from being, you know, infants to toddlers to the preschool years and elementary, and then we start really hitting that, you know, the tween to teen stage, and then going from there, and really life is a constant change. We're constantly having to change and adapt. And for so many people, if they don't have those coping skills, that's when we start to find ourselves in crisis.
Absolutely.
And so I would love to talk a little bit about, and I'm sure this could be a very long-winded conversation, but when we're talking about looking at our girls in terms of they're going to be going through a lot of changes, we know that. What are some things that parents really need to think about that what they can do to really support girls when they're going through those changes?
Well, my number one piece of advice to all of the parents, especially mothers that I work with, is start with yourself. Be really, really accepting of your own changes. There's this myth in our society that, you know, like you said, from childhood, infanthood even, all the way through to becoming an adult, it's accepted that, okay, they're toddlers and then they're this and then they're that and there's all these steps. But then there's just sort of this big hole where it's like, and then they're an adult for the majority of their life. And then you get into elderly and you get into all of those other things. But there's this myth that we're supposed to stay the same sort of in that time frame. Sure, maybe our career grows. Sure, maybe we have kids and we watch their growth. So often I have clients that come in, especially mothers, and it's this like, I'm trying so hard to be consistent for my kids. And consistency in bedtimes and daily schedules and things like that. Absolutely, so incredibly important. But we're human beings. We're naturally inconsistent. We're always growing. We're always changing. And it's exhausting to try and prevent that. So being accepting of your own changes, the fact that, oh, hey, you know what? I tried this new food and I like it. Or, you know, I never used to like these movies, but I'm going to give them a shot because my daughter likes them. And hey, I kind of like them now too, or whatnot. That's my first step with all my clients, is if you can be more accepting of your changes, you can always lead by example in that way. And your daughter, your children in general will start to see that it's okay. Because so much of, like you said, especially teenagers, is trying on who you're going to be, you think, when you grow up. Am I goth? Am I this? Am I that? How do I want to wear my hair today? Am I kind of preppy today? Am I whatever else? And feeling accepted in that, being able to be a different person every day, ultimately leads to being able to accept who you really are underneath all of those things that you try on so much easier.
Yeah. And you know, what sparks for me as well is my mission and what I'm all about is helping to educate parents and caretakers out there on different ideas and different ways of looking at things. And myself, I am an evolutionary parent, right? If I look back at what I was like as a parent, you know, 9 years ago, it's very different than the parent that I am today. It's very different than the parent that I'll be 10 years from now, right? And I think for moms to be able to stand back and say, there are certain things that we believe in, there are certain boundaries that we have, certain morals and certain values that we have that we uphold, but we have to be fluid in allowing ourselves to change how we parent based on what's going on in our life, what's going on in society, and our individual children, and being able to say, you know, we used to do this way, but mommy's thinking now this might not be the best fit for us. I'm going to try this now. And even modeling that behavior to our daughters shows that we can make changes. Maybe we try something and it doesn't work, and maybe it's not a good fit. You know, we need to try something else, and that's okay.
Absolutely. Well, and you used a really great word for it, of being an evolutionary parent. I love that. I think of it in terms of adaptability. So much of our species, so many species, is being able to adapt. And unfortunately, a lot of my adult clients that come in never learn those skills. And so how in the world are they supposed to teach them to their children? And so that's exactly it, is being able to practice that. Like you said, you know, mommy knows we used to do it this way, especially acknowledging it for your child so that they know that I know that we used to do it this way. I've decided I want to try it this way now. Shows them and teaches them that it's okay. Because one of the hardest things that I see moms especially come in with is this, I was trying to do this thing and that didn't work. And then they spend the next 5, 10, 40 years sometimes beating themselves up about the fact that, like, well, I started out trying to do this thing and it didn't work. And then they kind of didn't know where to go from there. And so I just kept ruminating on the fact that it didn't work and trying to make it work, when in actuality, it would have been a lot better for everyone involved to go ahead and just adapt to, okay, we thought that was a great idea, but you know what? The world changed through no fault of our own. Maybe it changed in an amazing way we were unexpecting. And now let's move forward and try this new frontier.
Yeah, I love that. So something that I wanted to talk with you today, and I was so excited about our conversation, was myself, I have really spent the last few years thinking about language and the language that we use and how language can have such an impact on our views, from being an entrepreneur and having a worth set, and how that ties into charging what you're worth, to I have some of my own word issues, I would say, where I was maybe called a term of endearment when I was younger. I'm from the Latin background, so one of the term of endearment for me was gordita, which means chubby or fat in Spanish. And while it's a term of endearment, I'm someone that's always struggled with my weight, and I had a very hard time with it. So I've always tried to really think thoughtfully about the language that I use, and I'm trying to constantly educate myself on the language that we use around our girls. So I'd really love to start, you know, kind of digging in on this topic about the power of language that it has.
Absolutely. It is one of my favorite topics in the whole world. I'm married to a writer. I minored in rhetorical English. You add that into the neurolinguistic programming, language is my life. And yeah, anyone who knows me knows that there are certain things you don't get away with saying around me. First off, I love that you are going to such an extent and being so careful with your languaging, especially because you understand the impact that it has. You've seen the impact that it's had for yourself. I always like to caution people, first thing first, give up on being perfect. We're all going to slip. We're all going to say things. But knowing that you make that effort, it's a lot more effort at first, as I'm sure you've noticed. But then you start to kind of get into practice of it. And there's certain words that you can cut out, and there's certain words that you can replace. And it's really incredible the difference that it makes. And one of my go-tos, my starting points for anybody that I talk with, is the word should. And I don't know if you're familiar with kind of the feelings and thoughts that tends to bring about for people, but generally it comes up around guilt. It's an inherent, automatic, without thinking about it, guilt. And so the running joke around my house is, you know, don't should on yourself.
I like that. And yeah, when you said that, when the minute you said the word should, my stomach dropped, because it brings up those feelings of unworthiness, I'm not good enough, the perfectionism that we constantly have behind ourselves, shame, guilt. Yep. Let's talk about that.
Absolutely. Well, and you just made a fantastic point about all those things that it brings up. And what it is that it immediately implies, well, it explicitly implies to the subconscious mind, especially, that there is an inherent right or wrong way to something. Now, okay, lots of legal things. Absolutely. Feel free to use the word should. You should or should not murder someone. Absolutely. Okay, that's a perfect area to use it in. Should or should not go to the store today? Obviously, that's an extreme jump. You know, that's one of my go-to examples with people, is just like, okay, oh, I should really go to the store later. Well, you're already beating yourself up. You're already dragging yourself down, and you're telling yourself that, for lack of a better word, I'm a terrible person if I don't get to the store later. Well, sometimes things come up, way more important things. Every mother knows something can come up with your kids and change your whole day. Your whole schedule can go out the window. And then you're left feeling like a terrible person because you didn't make it to the store. And how silly is that when you look back on it, you know? And the other side of it for me is, when you put that should on it, you negate any possibility to celebrate or feel a sense of completion or to feel productive from it, because you didn't go to the store and achieve accomplishing going to the store. You should go to the store. You have to go to the store. You did it. Okay, I met my expectation. And that doesn't feel very good. So a lot of positive psychology, things like that, brings in finding just the little joys in life. And it's just like, yeah, you know what? I didn't get all 150 things done on my list today, of course. But I went to the store. And so, yeah, I'm gonna crack open a bottle of wine tonight and celebrate. I at least made it to the store. I know plenty of people that do that at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that because, you know, you can look at a child that is in a situation where, let's say they see one child picking on someone else, and maybe they are struggling with finding their own voice, and they're still trying to navigate this idea of standing up for themselves in the face of adversity and other people, and they're thinking to themselves, I should really say something. I should really say something. And while they're sitting there and they're thinking, I should say something, they're coming up with the guilt because they don't know if they're going to do it or not. And if they don't do something because they're just not ready yet and they're not there, they're going to hold on to this feeling of not being good enough, not being worthy enough, and everything else that's associated with it. And if they do say something, they're not going to celebrate that because, well, I should have done it.
Yeah.
You know? And when it's instead of you should be thinking, I did that. I stood up for them. I made a great decision. And you take away all of that power and all of that reward if you do something good. And if you're not able to do that yet, you just add on more guilt.
Exactly. And it's such a clouding thing. So in that example with someone standing there and you know, they're seeing some bullying going on or they're seeing something going on, freeing up those higher thought processes to look at it and know that, yes, in general, it's nice to have someone step in. Yes, it can be very helpful. If it's a seriously dangerous situation, then maybe you shouldn't get involved directly. Maybe the right step is to go and find an adult. Maybe the right step is to go and report it in the office as a witness to what happened so that you can back up and corroborate. There's all of these other options too. And that's another thing in languaging that we can so quickly shut off so many of these options. And again, should puts into what we call in my office a light switch situation, of yes, no, right, wrong. You know, like you said, either I should do it or I shouldn't do it, or I should do it and I will or I won't. And that's so limiting and it's so shrinking. And really, there's no way to come out of that feeling great about it, even when you do such an amazing thing as standing up and helping somebody out. So yeah, should is not allowed in my house. Should is not allowed in my office. And that's one of my favorites in terms of languaging to start with.
Yeah, we're going to take that out of our vocabulary. I need to take that one out of mine because all day long I'm saying that. And now that we have this conversation, I'm like, oh my gosh. Yeah, that's, I'm feeling all of that. And so and in a way, I almost feel like it implies that I lack freedom of choice.
Right.
From using that. Like I don't have a choice really. Instead of saying I choose today to go to the store.
Exactly.
I'm going to go to Target and I'm going to get my errands done, you know, which feels awesome and powerful too. I really should go to Target. I mean, I don't even have the fancy Target.
Right.
So yeah, I love that. So what else? What's another language word that you don't allow, that you don't like?
Generally, one of the big ones, especially in neurolinguistic programming, is to be very careful with nots. So, especially in contractions and things. So, do not do this. Do not do that. Again, these are all very motherly words, right? I can hear my mom. I can hear my mother-in-law. I can hear every mom I know. Like, do you think you should be doing that? You know, oh, I don't think that we should be doing that. And so nots is, gosh, I remember in college, one of my professors making a perfect example of you can't picture not an elephant. You have to first picture the elephant and then remove the elephant. And that's the way the subconscious mind works. So a lot of times when we're giving ourselves order and directions and things like that, and especially when we're giving our children directions or suggestions, as it were, being careful of those knots, knowing that you were putting it directly into their mind first of like, can you not do that? Just like, well, I have to think about doing it before I can think about not doing it. And so again, rephrasing simply to, you know, is that really what you'd like to be doing right now? Or how do we feel about what's going on here? They are something definitely to keep in mind.
Yeah. In our house, I use a lot of, is that a good choice? Right? Because I like them to think that what they're doing is their choice. And yes. So I say, is that a good choice you're making? I'm not going to tell them whether or not it's a good choice or a bad choice. I'm going to let them think about it. And 9.5 out of 10 times, they know. Sometimes they don't. And then I'm like, whoa, hold on now. Then I can use no, right? If it's really dangerous.
Right.
You know, and I really tried to stop using the word no with my girls because it causes so many limiting beliefs. It causes so much sense of lack in so many ways. And also right. because if there was to be an emergency situation where they were doing something that was really potentially dangerous that maybe I couldn't stop them from quick enough where I needed to use my words, I needed a word that was actually going to have impact and quickly. And so,
yes,
you know, no for me was if something was really, really big out there. And I always tried to refer it back to being their choice. Is that your choice?
Yeah.
Or I would say, that's not my choice.
Right. And choice is such a powerful thing because, again, there's a phrasing about the person with the most options has the most control. So that's one reason that giving children and teenagers and everything else options, choices, is such a powerful thing. Now, the sticky part there is, I was just talking to someone else about this the other day, how to give them choices that feel like choices rather than choices that feel like an ultimatum. Because a lot of times the choices can be, well, you can do it this way or you can not do it at all. That doesn't feel like much of a choice.
Right.
Whereas, you know, as a parent, it takes a little bit extra effort sometimes to come up with two choices that you're okay with. But if you have two options of how they can do it, okay, sure, you can go out with your friends after school if you call me when you leave and you call me when you're on your way home. Or you can stay in today and have your friends over, you know, if that's better, rather than, you know, you can go out your friends this way, this, that, and the other, or you can just stay in your room, you know. Obviously, that's not going to feel like as much of a choice for them. That feels like they're being given one option or they're being punished. So yeah, choices are huge.
Yeah, the choices are great. The choices are great with toddlers. And I've always told people that. Toddlers are fighting for independence. That's all they want. They want to feel like big people and they want to make choices. And it almost became a game in our home because our girls are really good at trying to outsmart us. But my husband and I have gotten really good at this game of choices. And so we never really like to say no, like I said before. So we would always find choices. So it would be Aria would say, I don't want to brush my teeth tonight. And obviously, you know, we need to brush our teeth. It's good for our bodies, blah, blah, blah. And I'm not going to just say, you have to brush your teeth. And I would say, I understand. Would you like to brush your teeth now before you get your pajamas on? Or would you like to brush your teeth after you get your pajamas on? And most of the time she would pick, right? She was like, oh, wow, choice. I get to make a choice. It almost like derails the whole idea that I didn't want to do that.
Exactly.
Or choice, you know, with clothing. And I'm very much more liberal with allowing my children to dress themselves. And I understand these are, you know, some parents need baby steps on letting go with the clothing choices. And so you could always say, well, would you like to wear this shirt or that shirt? Or would you like to wear these shoes or those shoes? Or, you know, with food. And it's such an easy way to make parenting easier. Yeah. There's less battles. There really is.
Right.
But you got to get creative.
Well, and I remember one day, just seeing the most profound example of this for me, I was sitting at probably a Burger King or something. And I was probably sitting there working. I don't know. I was there for a while. And I saw parents go through and check out with their kids. And they went over to the drink machine. And there was no lead up. They just walked over there and they went to get drinks. And the kids wanted, I don't know, Mountain Dew or something, which, okay, that's a lot of parents' nightmare, right? To give their little one Mountain Dew. And so they walked over there and it became this whole battle, and the child broke down into a tantrum, and it was this whole thing. And of course, you can't help noticing this when you're sitting there. Everyone there couldn't help noticing it. And then, I don't know, probably 20 minutes later, saw a different family come through with their little one. And it was amazing how differently it was handled. They walked very calmly over to the drink station. And the father, I believe it was, actually said, you know, would you like high C or would you like Sprite? And it was completely calm. And the kids stood there and very contemplative and really thought about it for a minute and decided to go with high C. And that was the end of the conversation. And it was totally calm and it was totally beautiful to witness, especially in comparison. They had a much more limited selection than the other child did, but the other child probably had just as limited a selection of what the parent was willing to let them have. So setting those boundaries right up front, but still giving the child that sense of control, not just choosing for them and not giving them options that they were later going to have removed, was huge.
Totally. And a lot of times it's you being the first one to suggest it. It's a little bit harder to backtrack on it when they're already saying they want that. Because yeah. Then it does feel like a no, but I think knowing you're going, and most of us can tell with our children where we know there's going to be a ruffle of feathers, you know, and being able to think ahead of time and give the choice ahead of time, you know, kind of dissolves any chance that you're going to have that epic battle. And sometimes the epic battle happens, and then that's when you throw in another parenting skill that you've learned along the way to kind of dissolve the tantrum. Talk to me about the words like never and always.
Yes. I'm so glad that you brought those up. So the funny thing about being a human being, right, is this thing called cognitive dissonance. And that is when basically a situation comes up that we don't have a clear answer for. Maybe we don't have all the information we need. Maybe we're not ready to make that decision, whatever else. And it's that sense, that feeling that we're all very familiar with of basically, I don't know what to do. It's the start of a lot of fights when people don't know where they want to go for dinner with their spouse or their significant other, right? Of that just feeling of, I don't know. Because there isn't an inherent right answer to where do we go for dinner, generally. Some people will argue that. But so the way that the mind works, the human mind anyways, is we have a tendency to do one of three things when we're stuck in that cognitive dissonance place, because we want to get out of it as quickly as possible. It's very physically uncomfortable as well as emotionally uncomfortable, even over the simplest of things. And the first thing that we generally go to is generalizations, which is the nevers, it's the always, it's the everybody, it's the, you know, things along those lines. It's a oversimplification more often than not. And it is a fantastic way to pick up limiting beliefs. It is a fantastic way to shrink yourself into a very tiny and very uncomfortable box of, and oh my gosh, it's so common with kids because everything is so intense for them. And being in school, being around their friends, all of that social stuff as they're growing up is like being just stuck in a fishbowl. Because some days it really does feel like everybody hated their hair or everybody was making fun of them, especially as we go into adulthood. But more often than that, even as a teenager, it's, oh my God, it was the most popular in school, a person in school that saw that. Then everybody knows. So being able to dial back from that, well, was it really everybody? Who specifically was it? Well, what did they actually say? And breaking it all down. Not always the most comfortable conversation, because again, it can pull you back into that place of cognitive dissonance. Maybe saying everybody feels better right now than realizing, okay, it was seven people instead of three or instead of, you know, four. But long term, knowing that not everybody saw what you did in the cafeteria today, it's okay. You know what? Everybody will forget about it though, because tomorrow somebody else is going to do something and life moves on. Never is a huge one. And always, those are both extremely limiting. They cut off so much in terms of, you know, God, I always do really bad on tests. The simplest one is just to switch it to like, well, I used to do really bad on tests, but you know what? Tomorrow's the new day. So here's a chance to go in, and this could be the very first time that you do extremely well on a test, you know? Because as I like to think of the movie with Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the Johnny Depp version, where the parents have to point out that, well, sometimes when grown-up say forever, they just mean a very long time. Understanding that and being able to teach that to children of just like being careful of those words, but knowing that again, you can adapt away from, okay, never doesn't have to mean never, always doesn't have to mean always. And never is a tough one, especially for parents, because there's a lot of things that you would love for your child to never do, I'm sure. But there's a lot of them that you accept and acknowledge that when they grow up, they're probably going to do it. Dads, I know a lot with daughters, it's like, nope, she's never going to date. Well, realistically, someday that's going to change. So sometimes when parents say forever, they just mean a very long time.
Well, thank you so much, Sierra. It was so great to have you. I hope our listeners found this topic enlightening and have picked up some new ideas, insights, and tips along the way. I know I've grabbed quite a few to throw into my pocket. To find out more about Sierra, you can find her at embraceyourpassion.co. To hear the rest of this interview as we further explore this topic and look at how to address I can't statements, choosing whether or not words have power over you, talking about your daughter's appearance or looks, nicknames, and more, please join our community at raisingapowerfulgirl.com. We look forward to seeing you there.
You are a leader and a role model to developing girls. Whether you're raising a daughter or you work with girls on a daily basis, you see the incredible potential they have to make a difference in this world. You know the change we need is going to come from them, and you want to make sure they grow up to be independent leaders with a strong sense of personal identity, because these are the traits that make a powerful girl. So come join our community and education platform at raisingapowerfulgirl.com and become a part of our movement to educate, inspire, and cultivate a generation of powerful girls with eye-opening discussions and facts, exercises, and tangible calls to action. We can't wait to see you there.
Have you ever asked yourself this question? Why is it so hard to make a buck? I know I have. Hi, I'm Sandra Yancey, founder and CEO of eWomen Network. What I have discovered after going from the brink of bankruptcy to running a multi-million dollar award-winning business is this. You can't build a million-dollar dream hanging around minimum wage mindsets. My mission is 1 million women entrepreneurs generating $1 million in annual revenue. So here's what I've done. I've created the mother of all entrepreneur success programs that you can access online on your time. It's called Monetize Me Now. It's a 7-module online course that is 100% my success formula, covering mindset, mission, management, motivation, marketing, and measure. Come on, take my hand and I'll show you the way to learn to earn flowing revenue for your business. Visit monetizemenow.com for details.
Thanks for joining us. This is the EWN Podcast Network.